You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. In this podcast, you'll learn how to identify and overcome the gaps between different points of view in public and private discourse. The session was facilitated by Dr. Grant Tate, CEO and Managing Partner of The Bridge LTD, a Charlottesville consulting company that helps leaders make difficult decisions. He is the founder of three small companies and was co-founder of the New Mexico Technical Innovation Center and Connecticut Venture Center, organizations formed to help formulate and grow entrepreneurial companies. Before starting The Bridge LTD, Grant was an executive at IBM, where he led a software development lab, introduced new products, and managed reorganization of a high-tech division. Dr. Tate spoke at the Wednesday, January 14, 2015 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. The meeting was held at the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. The program was moderated by SSV board member Terry Cooper. Our podcast is entitled Bridging the Gap, Listening to People You Don't Want to Hear. Here's Terry Cooper.
I'm Terry Cooper. I have the pleasure of working with Grant Tate. We are both volunteers with One Virginia 2021. Grant is the founder and CEO of The Bridge Limited. To describe what they do, let me use the analogy of an organization to an automobile. And Grant works to tune up the engines on those automobiles to make the organizations more effective. And since organizations are composed of people, there is a lot of work on conflict resolution and conflict avoidance. So, Grant Tate.
Thank you very much. I'm going to say a few words to kind of see if this thing is tuned up. Can you hear me now? Yeah, okay, good, good. It was funny because the paper little article said Grant Tate, expert in conflict resolution. And I said to my wife, I didn't know I was an expert in conflict resolution. And she said, I thought that's what you did. But it caused me to do a lot of thinking about the kind of work that I do. I don't work a lot with politicians directly in my paid work. I do work with organizations, and Terry has described it quite accurately, and lots of times the car hardly runs. And when the car hardly runs, then we have to get involved in something that we call turnaround, which is what do we have to do with the people and with the organization to really turn this into an organization. Some things that have struck me on this conflict resolution over the years, and I've served in some volunteer things with local governments, planning commissions and things of that sort, and it's always surprised me at how the skill of debate is so sparsely held. If people get mad, they basically will run away. A good example in the paper these days, and somebody has commented on that, and wherever you stand on this conflict going on in New York City about the police and the criticism of police and so forth, but one of the commentators said, to turn your back on a confrontation is not really a way to solve it. And that's generally the way I feel about it. Sort of as a basic philosophy, I was thinking about my principal at Orange High School years and years ago, who said this to me. And by the way, I'm going to read the slides, not that I think you can't read them, but because this is a podcast, they don't have the slides, so I'll read you stuff that's on the slides. Everyone has some good in them, it's your job to find it. And that theme is one that I just remembered from my interaction, hearing him say it many, many times. And it's sort of been a watchword as I've gone through the years. And as I think about the people who were my mentors over my career and the people whom I really admired, that was sort of the philosophy, to look for what's good. And so that's been something that I think is sort of an important theme here. And so the question that I would like to raise with you is, what can we do as individuals to help bridge the gap. When I get a group of people together and a group of people has trust issues, we can't ask somebody else to trust me. We can ask them, but nothing happens. But the thing we can do is to be trustworthy, to take the risk on trusting the other people. And once when we have those sessions, lots of times I'll ask the group to make an individual pledge that says, I'm willing to trust other people in the group. Everybody takes the pledge, and everybody takes that risk. Then you can start to develop trust in the organization. So let's test your reaction. What do you think of this guy? Would you want to walk up and talk to him? I'm glad you can't read his t-shirt, because it's not something I'd want to read in this group. Okay, what about this fellow? Same guy. And so how one gets presented, so take a look at this group of people. Now, if you're like most of us, each one of those people evokes some emotional response. You have some response to each one of those people. You may agreeing with somebody who's on that chart is an emotional response, or disagreeing, or, oh, I think so-and-so. And so where does that come from? We all have our individual screens and filters that has an effect on how we see things, how we hear things, and how we respond. How well we can hear, how well we can see. And psychologists have done a lot of work with that, and they could find out that people with a certain frame of mind and certain things go in the room, if they're thinking one thing, they can't even see a person walk across the room if they're too focused on one thing. As I put this up, I thought, okay, that young woman is screaming at looking at that fellow without the shirt. But there are some young women who would probably say, wow, that's cute. Point of view, right. Okay, so let's think about where that comes from. Daniel Kahneman, who is a Nobel Prize winner in economics, although he is a psychologist, has written a book called Thinking Fast and Slow. It's a little long, but I'll read it to you. I call it theory-induced blindness. Once you have accepted a theory and used it as a tool in your thinking, it is extraordinarily difficult to notice its flaws. If you become upon an observation that does not seem to fit the model, you assume that there must be a perfectly good explanation that you're somehow missing. In other words, we self-justify ourselves. And so think about that as we move along here. So let's look at how that system works. And this is, if you think about in our own mind, how do we respond to things? First of all, there's a stimulus. We see something, we hear something, we encounter something, and it's popped into our lives, our brains. The next is our own interpretation. What does that mean? Where did that come from? Who is that? What am I hearing? And then there's an emotional response that is triggered based on a lot of things that we'll talk about in a few minutes. And then there's a behavioral choice. And I may decide that I'm going to confront it, or I'm going to run away, I'm going to learn more, whatever. And then the last thing is action. And after that would be, what are the consequences of what happened? Okay, so let's think about some examples of how this might work. Here's a work situation. I'm working on my computer and preparing this presentation. I'm really focused on it. And here comes my manager across the room and starts to look over my shoulder. So response one is, my assumption is, here she comes again. She's always criticizing my work. I know that all the work I've done is probably going to be criticized, and it's just going to create a lot of problems for me to rework this thing based on my assumption. So she arrives, starts to say, well, I'd love to see, you know, what are you working on? I'd love to see your presentation. And I'm thinking, go away. Okay, reset, new assumption. Working on this presentation, a manager walks across the room, and I say, wow, here comes my manager. You know, I'm really stuck on this chart. I'm wondering what she thinks about it. She's really good with us. So she walks up and said, and I say, well, how would you like to take a look at this chart with all the steps? You think, how do you think people will respond? And what then is the result of that conversation? Now, from her point of view, my assumption is going to dictate the way she responds. Because if I'm hostile, unless she's really conscious of changing the dynamic, she's going to get defensive about it as well. I can control the situation by the assumption I make. Even if she's been hostile in other situations, I can assume she's there to help me. It will change the dynamic. And so the other thing about this is, and Kahneman in his book, Thinking Fast and Slow, said there are really two systems. Oops, sorry, wrong thing. Yeah. So our core values, our attitudes, and our experiences go into the interpretation. And so if I'm thinking fast, then what Kahneman calls systems one, fast thinking, then it's going to be a very emotional kind of response. Now, in my younger years, I was in the United States Army. Had my training with the 82nd Airborne, and I was never in combat, but there was a single response that still stays with me. If I hear a loud noise, a loud bang, I'm going to the floor. It's built in. That's my fast thinking mode. My slow thinking mode might be that loud noise. Oh, it might be a car backfire or, you know, whatever. But the idea behind this thinking path is that if we have a negative response, unless we have an emergency, it might still be a good idea to go to the floor but hear a loud bang. But if we're dealing with something that might be a conflict, we should slow down and examine our assumptions. And so speed counts. So system one is the fast reaction, which says I'm going to flow through that really fast. And system two is the thinkers slow down, do it system two. Now, Kahneman spends a whole big, thick book in that Thinking Fast and Slow to demonstrate that this one leads us to bad conclusions quite often. React too fast. When we work with groups, we do a set of personal assessments, and one of them, as many of you may have taken in your life, a DISC test that stands for decisiveness, interaction, stability, and caution. And people who are really high on the decisiveness side are quick deciders. And I always say that that's one of the people you need in the room if somebody shouts fire, takes you to the door. The opposite is somebody who's really high in caution, very low on decisiveness. But if you put those two people in a group, I can guarantee conflict. But I can also guarantee that if they learn to work together, it's more creative than people in the same style. Oh, so sorry, I've got the sequence. So basically what I'm saying is slow down and test your assumptions. Okay, so one word for that filter is called attitude. Now, when I worked for IBM years ago, they would say people come with attitude and you can't change it. But years of study in psychology and others have said, yes, you can. So what do we mean by attitude? Basically, it's habits of thought. And so think about that from the, in electronic terms, it would be something that's called a read-only memory. You put in a certain input, you can guarantee a certain output. And prejudice is a good example of it. And people who have prejudice, and all of us do to some degree or the other, then we have an automatic response if we see somebody that fits the category of the person we're prejudiced against. That's our fast response. But our slow response can be to say to ourselves, that's not fair, I need to be more open-minded, I need to listen to this person, and I'm not going to let my prejudices get in the way. But the attitude is also programmed by experiences. Now, I talked about the loud noise thing, but when I walk down New York City today, I never walk close to the buildings. Now, why is that? Anybody who's lived in New York City knows. I've been mugged. Yeah. So it's your my eyes are bright, looking, sweeping the street now, and I know what to look to. But programmed by experiences. And hardened by self-reinforcement, the messages we keep telling ourselves. So if we just, and this is the age factor, folks. As we get older, our attitudes get hardened. We're less flexible than we were when we were young. I put myself in that category as well. And it's an accumulation of internal images, messages. One of the things we do in our coaching process is we tell people to give themselves affirmations. It sounds like a silly idea. And what that means is take 3x5 cards and write on the 3x5 cards what you want to be, what you want to accomplish, and whatever. You know, I am a good person. I'm going to be a successful speaker today. Those kinds of things. And we tell people to read them to yourself in the morning, particularly look in the mirror, read themselves at lunchtime, read it to yourself at night, and it's almost magical. And what it's doing is replacing the negative messages in your head that says, you know, I'm really not a good speaker. Those people are going to not like what I say. You know, I really failed that test last week, so I must not be such a good person. And so one of the ways you can change the attitude is by changing the messages. So let's look at that a little deeper. So all of us get a collection of positive and negative messages. And if you're a woman, particularly in the age group or those around, you've probably gotten messages, you can be a nurse, but you can't be a doctor. Or if you're an African-American person, you can work in the post office, but you can't be an engineer. Now, where do those messages come from? Society, people you meet, whatever. And just think of the way we raise our children. Don't touch a hot stove. Don't cross the road without looking. Don't. I was at the athletic club a few weeks ago, and a woman was walking, getting ready to cross the street, holding the hand of a little girl, probably around 3 years old. And she said to the little girl, "What do we do before we cross the street?" And the little girl looked up and said, "We look both ways, Mommy." And I go, "Yeah, positive message, not a negative message." She didn't say, "Don't cross the road without looking." But people who have the attitude that says, "I can't do it. I, even though I work hard, I can't do it," have more negatives than positives, basically, if you in this theory of, and it starts at birth. So two people, Hart and Risley, published a paper. Their research went back in the 80s, but if you look this up on the web, you can find the research. And what they did was look at the number of words that children hear in the first 4 years of life. And looked at three groups: children of professional families, professional working class families, and and children of welfare families. And if you look at the result out there at the age 48 months, the difference between the welfare family and the professional family was something like 30-some million words. Now, what's the effect? And so the vocabulary result was that after, this was 36 months now, that the huge difference in vocabulary, in the number of words that the children were able to use at age 3 or 4. The other result in the test was that the number of positive, ratio of positive to negative words in the professional group, the positive to negative words was 6 to 1, more positive than negative. In the welfare group, it was not quite that upside down, but it was more negatives than positives by a factor of over 2 to 1. And the other thing that wasn't listed in the research that caused me to wonder is that when you think about the words that were used, what was the vocabulary that they actually had? So if you think about education, you think about training, you think about how do you communicate across different groups, this has a profound effect. And as the people at Curry School will tell you, that without intervention by a mentor or by a system that really helps with childhood education or something, that gap continues through school. And so one of the things that when we're doing organization building and so forth is to try to look at the person's background and background of vocabulary and so forth. When I'm working with a manager who's having communication problems with people, one of the things I say to them is, imagine that you're talking to somebody who lives in a two-dimensional world. In other words, draw a two-dimensional person on a piece of paper. And then you put a pencil through that piece of paper. What do they see? Circle. They can't see the pencil. And so to be able to describe that this is a pencil on the piece of paper, you have to use some language that they can understand. You have to use two-dimensional language. And you might have to say, you know, look at the shadow. Where does the shadow come from? That shadow actually comes from something you can't see, but I can describe it to you. That becomes really important. But all this feeds into the attitude. And so if you've been in an environment where you've been peppered with negative words, then that becomes important in the way you see things. Another piece of research that's really become important is Carol Dweck out at Stanford University defined, and this is working with young children again, two different mindsets. One mindset says, I am whom I am and I can never change, which is that, you know, the world's against me and whatever. The other set is, say, I'm a learning person. I can try it. I can do it if I really try. And that attitude, of course, comes from the kind of upbringing that people have. And there's certain to say also the genetics might have an impact. But if you can get somebody with this kind of attitude, then I know through training and development and just giving them new experiences that you can build them into success in their job or career of where they want to go. So we go back and look at this again. Is okay, I can't go back to those negatives and tell you, if I go back and say, you've been told I can be I can work in the post office, but I can't work as an engineer. I can go back and tell you time and time again, you know, you can. You really can. It doesn't really work. It's hard to cancel those negative messages. But what I can do is increase the size of the set. And so I can start to give the person experiences that demonstrates that if they apply themselves, they can really improve and can work. And for that to work, you have to provide a feedback system that says, okay, here's what you did well, let's build on that, and let's go to the next try. And if you've ever seen Gladwell's book about, I forgot the name of the book right off, but anyway, this 10,000 hours idea. The whole idea takes 10,000 hours to make an expert. But inherent in that, whether that number's right or wrong, is something called deliberate practice. And deliberate practice says that if you keep trying over and over and improving, that you can eventually get to be an expert. And that so deliberate practice is defined as try something, get feedback, correct, try it again, and keep going around the circle. And so if you look at golfers, you look at athletes, you look at military officers, you look at managers and people, most people who are really highly accomplished have been through that cycle. And so in this way, what you really can get people to do is to help define what is going to be important to them, help them practice, give them good feedback, and build on it. Here's a small but silly example. I was giving a briefing to a department. I hadn't met all the members, but they had done a survey that we do. And the group came into the room, and one of the people was sitting there with this really mean look on her face. And I'm going, oh my gosh, what do I do about this? By this time, the rest of the people who came in, I didn't want to challenge her to say, are you okay, or whatever, and I decided just to ignore it and move on, and I did. But after the meeting, I brought in the person who was her manager and said, what's going on here? And she said, oh, that's Mary. She has trouble at home. She has conflict at work, and I said, well, what are you doing about it? She said, well, once a month I bring her in and say, you know, if you don't improve, we're going to fire you. And what happens? Well, she improves a week or so, and then what happens the next month? Bring her in again, same routine. So we said, after we talked about 45 minutes, said, okay, let's try something. Let's have Mary write down 5 positive interactions she has every day. And at the end of the week, you bring Mary in and say, okay, by now you should have had 25. Let's talk about at least 5 of them. And then you say, great, you're doing a good job. Go to the next week. Well, what happened in that case was in Mary getting now starting to focus on positive interactions, opened the gate to her fellow workers. And they were able to come in and now open things up. And a couple months later, she was integrated into the department and it was stopping the wrist slapping. And that was a good example of focusing on the positive and giving the encouragement. So basically enlarge the box. Now, part of the also in creativity, one of the things you'll always hear is get outside the box. Think outside the box. And one of the questions is how do you kick the wall down? Work on your assumptions. All those, that box that we have is built in from our culture, our experiences, our attitudes, and where we come from, and whatever. And the easiest way to increase the creativity of a group is bring in a deviant. And one of the hardest things to teach managers, by the way, is how to deal with the creative deviant. They always want to say, clip this person's wings. But so that really says, circling back to where we started, was that to really get outside of our confinement, our cultural confinement, our attitudinal confinement, we have to open the gates and expand and be willing to accept and listen to new ideas. It doesn't mean we have to accept them and put them into effect, but to understand. And as the fellow who wrote Seven Habits of Highly Successful People wrote, it's seek first to understand and then to be understood. I think that's a pretty good guideline. So what can we do? Slow down. Use Systems 2, which says when we confront something that is somebody we don't want to hear or some new attitude or something that's going to challenge us, maybe make us uncomfortable, is slow down and say, what's keeping me from listening to this? And then decide. Identify your assumptions. What am I bringing to this that says I can or can't listen to that person? Turn the funnel upside down. And what I mean by that is if you go back to school, we're all taught to be critical thinkers. We hear all this stuff, we're trying to boil it down, say, what does it mean, and take a critical look at it. The other way of looking at it would be, the idea comes in, how can I expand it? How does that apply? How can I apply it in other places? And take an expansive view of it. Broaden your reading and listening. Give yourself positive messages. Use affirmations to encourage those. Identify and ignore snarl words, that is, the kind of words that cut off conversation. If somebody is using them on you, you might give them some advice that you could understand them better if they didn't use that kind of language, and don't use them yourself. And identify bias in yourself and others. And these are just some basic guidelines that I think would be helpful. And so if you consider the conflict that you see every day in your everyday world, if you consider what goes on in politics and the public forums and such, then I think the way we make progress is by examining ourselves. We can't say to the other person, you've got to change. Thank you very much.
This is an interactive session. Now, because we're taping this, please don't ask a question until you have the microphone in your hand. I'll call on you, and then one of these gentlemen will give you a microphone and go ahead. Start off, Jim. Anybody on that side have a question?
My name is Tom Donnells. How are you doing?
Tom, you got a good voice.
Oh, thanks. I work for Big Blue, too.
Oh, great. Good.
And as
good
you may recall, the organization got into a rut, so to speak. And at one point of time, the losses were so big that they had to change, but they couldn't change. And that is so true with all of us. However, you have heard of a guy by the name of Lou Gerstner, who came in and made the elephant dance. It's very difficult to do in between your ears, though. I've had to do it. And it takes years of practice and practice to begin to rewire and change that whole process. And in day-to-day living, I can attest it's extremely tough to do. But do you have any mantras or whatever we could practice?
Yes, several, I think. One is that, by the way, we in this series of assessment tests we do, we test for that characteristic. And the S is stability. So people who are high on stability in this test are typically difficult people to change. People who are really low want change for change's sake. They don't like to do anything twice. but all of us, what you've described is a general cultural context. And so I was one of those when I left IBM. I left before the crash, and I felt that, and it's the old trite saying that I didn't leave the company, left me. And the reason was because I thought that there were some things going on that I was aware of that I didn't think were true to the values. And I took the opportunity and I went, never looked back. At the individual level, one thing that people talk about is to try some experiences that are way outside of your set. which is to purposely go to go try some things that you would never want to try because it seems too risky to your ego or to your talents or whatever. And it's been curious to me also on the IBM set is I often wondered why a lot of the IBM executives who went out and went into the public world, that is politics and others, weren't really good at it. And part of the answer for that, I think, is the difference between authority and influence. Because in IBM, we had a really tight culture and had a lot of powerful values that were very good. But we weren't out in the world where our power had to do with the amount of influence that we had. So in a big company like that, if somebody new walked in the door and they had an IBM badge, they automatically had some credibility with you. In the outside world, you don't know that. And so in the political world, you have to use relationships and cross-influence to be able to be successful. How do you do it in an organization? I have an example that's going on right now with I've got three companies I'm working with, two of which have issues, and we just tested a group of managers, and the big question we are wrestling with is just that question. Can these people change? We've described to them why they need to change, and it's pretty clear. Can demonstrate it culturally, can demonstrate it market-wise, can demonstrate it in numbers. Not sure they even believe us. And so the net result is that they can't bring themselves to say we need to do things differently and be willing to learn, then the shock treatment is that other people might be there to do it. That's the bloody reality of it. And part of my job is to deliver that message. But also part of my job is to try to help people get to the point where they can accept what needs to be done and look at the thrill of being able to try something new and grow with it. I don't know if that answers your question. Yeah, right? Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Tell me how you find the good in people like Amedy Coulibaly and the Kouachi brothers.
Yeah, that's really a hard one. I've asked myself that question a lot because there's always there's a philosophical thing, is there any such thing as evil? You know, are there people that are just evil people that have no redeeming values? I still have trouble believing that. And so if we had the opportunity before the incident happened, and those two young men were sitting here, I would certainly try to find something that was good. These are two young guys who probably had a mother, had a family, had some experiences growing up, but also influences that took them over the edge. And so if you could reel it back, obviously this question is on the table right now, about if we have communities that are developing terrorists in this country, and we know we do, is how do you intervene in that process? And you won't solve the process, in my viewpoint, by wrist slapping and negative methods. You can't just slap them in jail. You have to go for what's good and try to influence what's good.
I'm enjoying your talk. I'm a mediator here at the Mediation Center of Charlottesville, and we are expanding into elder care mediation to help families and parents move forward with their plans for later life. Could you give me some tips on dealing with multi-party mediation technique? I saw that in the advertisement for this talk.
I take no responsibility for false advertising. Yeah. Explain multi-party again.
It would be the children trying to help. It would be the children trying to help mom, whether she moves into an assisted living facility, stays in her house, resolving the conflicts between the children. We understand there's a lot of stuff coming to the table, and are there tricks that you would use to help smooth the process?
Let me explain how it works in my context, and then see if it does any parallels. One of the groups that we're getting together next week in a retreat has some team issues. They are all in the, they're sort of a basic core, and then you've got a couple people that are sort of on the edges. Now, what's different about it is that the cultural context, of course, is totally different. But one of the things we do is that when we do these assessments, part of the sheets that come out of the report are, here are the strong points, here's how this person likes to be communicated with and such. We put those in an envelope and we put the person's name on it, and I put all those in the middle of the floor, and each person picks up somebody else's name, and we open these, and then we go around the room and talk about, here's this person's strong point. And the person is sitting there saying, yeah, I agree with that, or no, I don't. Somebody would say, no, I hear that strong point. That is not the way I see it. And so basically what I'm doing is trying to get down to the common level of understanding. And I haven't dealt with children in that context, so I don't know the answer to that. But to me, one of the basic questions is, how do you feel? How are you feeling now? To try to find the common ground of what's feeling good, what's not feeling good, and that sort of thing. I don't know if that's helpful or not, but
I feel the urge to add a little. I'm over here to your right. Right here. I'm Sue Liberman, and most of you know I'm a geriatric care manager. So that's what I do, is work with families all day where adult children feel they know best what's for us, essentially. And in one sentence, I usually can affect families by asking the adult children, why are you pushing this decision? Is it for your comfort or for your mom's or dad's? And that usually gets people going towards the same page.
Well, I might say something about generational gaps, though. And my generation gap is with the millennials and the folks, and you know, me, a younger. And what I've found out in working with some really brilliant college students is that we older folks tend to put them into more trivial tasks and don't listen enough. And so, again, in a sense, dealing with the brilliant deviant is that, you know, for older folks in the mix of a room, I would essentially say, shut up and listen. Yes.
This goes back to when we were talking about change a little bit earlier, and how you and your organization might address resistance to change in individuals that need to change within the context of the organization, or it could be in any kind of system. And how, do you have any particular methodologies that you use in addition to the DISC system?
Yeah. Well, the first question is, how bad is it? And so you have to have an assessment to know, do we have to do minor changes or do we have to be big-time changes? And a couple of theorists apply. One is a guy named Kurt Lewin, who basically has said to change a hard, frozen organization, you have to unfreeze it, go about the change, and then refreeze it to the new format. And I was joking earlier that, you know, going back to the IBM thing, I was director of organization for one of the divisions. We call it structural intervention. So we had an organization that we needed to change. You change the top guy, you change the next level down, say fix it, and we go to the next problem. It wasn't quite that harsh, but it was strong intervention with basically new people. The second is something they call force field analysis. And so if you're trying to move a wall, you look at all the forces to move the wall and all the forces that are keeping you from moving the wall. You try to neutralize these and try to reinforce these. And the same would apply in a group. And so if any of you have had physics and dynamics, we use something that's called a force that's got direction and value. And if you add up the forces in an organization, I'm trying to take it there. Here's somebody who's a drag on the system. Here's somebody actively against it. You can add up all those factors and see what has to be done. And the harsh thing is that in most small organizations, if you can identify the drags on the system and change them, you can achieve remarkable results. And if organizations don't have that flexibility, then hang on for the long pull.
Yeah. You mentioned politics. Can you give us some tips on how to find any good in a member of the Tea Party?
Well, absolutely. I presume you say that if you're not in the Tea Party.
Why I say it is to bring up the matter of intractable opposition. And we want to know how to break through that. The reason we want to do that on the local level, at least, is so we can get some legislation accomplished.
Yeah. Well, it goes back to the point that, you know, what are my biases? If I think that the Tea Party is a bunch of nuts, then my filter goes in place, mm-hmm. and I don't hear anything.
Yep.
And so one of the things that intrigues me about this whole discussion is that you hear the big government, small government argument, but I don't see us putting a lot of meat on that bone. I think it's a really valuable discussion. And so people who are saying, we're not being heard, you're not telling us we need smaller government, we need to reflect and understand what that means. So, keep going.
Do we have techniques for doing that? I thought this was going to be like a workshop. Do we have means of interrupting that wall against wall? Do we have means of? I don't want to say bridging the gap, because a bridge has two ends. I want to say.
Meet in the middle of the bridge.
But not even that. But transform the landscape. Why is there no common ground politically? Why do we have no common ground among us?
Well, we've got a lot of other people who want to say something. Let's expand on the question and then see.
I want to expand on Henry's question. I didn't just think of the Tea Party. I thought of all of Congress. If these techniques can work, why can't they be? Why aren't people in your field trying to work in general on our political parties and scenes and trying to bring people together?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I haven't heard the answer.
Grace, actually, something like that is happening this weekend.
I'm sorry.
Something like that is happening this weekend. The Republicans in the House and Senate are having their annual retreat to, Hershey, Pennsylvania. And they typically will have one or more speakers along those lines.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's hear the other questions, and then we'll get, and then I'll
I don't have a question, but a comment on that. I was thinking in terms of mediation, and I've had the privilege of working with some very intelligent, very experienced people in various areas. And when they disagree, I often see the problem as not that they're not doing a force field analysis, as you put it, but rather that each of them is doing a force field analysis for their own side, and there is no objective person. So how do you find an objective person when you have a situation like that?
This
is a comment. One, Henry, I think you wrote the article that prompted us to have Grant come, and this is, so it's nice to meet you. I'm on the board, and this was sort of dumped on me by the president, who managed not to be here today, so he can't give you the full explanation, but this idea of finding common ground, of taking people that are at the extremes and pushed further to the extremes in the course of their conversation with an opposing view. And so this is the beginning of a process which you started. And in March, we have a program where we have two people with very different points of view. And Grant, to your point, Hanse, will be the moderator. So this is kind of step one. It's our small way. No, can we go down to Washington? I've been there, done that. I'm here. And how do you start this conversation where people look for the teamwork to get things that need to be done, that can be done, as opposed to all of the time spent on things where people are never going to agree because the emotions run too high? It's a little bit of where do you start?
Go ahead. I went through the Sorensen program here at UVA. It's a 10-month long program with a main focus on that very issue, is to try to increase the dialogue. There's, I think, 20-some members of the General Assembly now that are graduates of Sorensen, and those of us who have been through the program spend a lot of time talking about this issue. If the thing that strikes me about Washington is that if we brought two of those people from opposing sides into this room, I'm pretty sure we could get a decent conversation going. A lot of people have commented on this, but the old collegiality, where you used to go to parties and, you know, eat breakfast together and all the things that happened in the old congressional setting, is now replaced by people flying back to their districts to get reinforced against their side. The other thing, of course, that's happened, and that's why I was very interested in this whole redistricting idea, is that our gerrymandering has now set us aside where we reinforce the extremes. And so when you have gerrymandered it so that the main competition is within the extremes of each party, then when those people come together, there they are. Now, in theory, if they did enough talking, you'd come together. But if you're just designing it like a combative system, then it's not going to work. Part of my answer for it is it's all up to us, because it's up to us to start to influence people and to get out. And the fact that we only get 30-some% of the people out for a vote is pretty sad. But and yet, in the redistricting argument, it said, well, why should I vote? Because it's pretty well determined. But it just means that all of us have to start speaking up stronger. I'm a child of the 60s, so I think, well, maybe we need to get to the streets again. Yeah.
I think that one thing we're overlooking is who benefits from this situation.
Who benefits from the gridlock Congress?
Yes.
Who do you think?
You're the one here.
Yes, I do.
Who are the lobbyists?
I mean, there's an awful lot of money that's being put into this for somebody's advantage, and it certainly isn't ours. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
The part of the problems in when we start to extend outside of a single organization and begin to look at social problems, broader, you know, cultural problems, is that people have legitimate grievances. I mean, there is strong injustice that they suffer from, and the people who are criticizing them often are blind to that injustice. Now, within a single organization, how do you handle it when you've got people who are on the bottom of the rung and they may be pretty disgruntled, but their grievances are valid, mm-hmm. and the problem is the boss who hired you to come in and fix a thing?
Yeah. I'm going to slightly vary that and talk about in a different context. And this is part, I generalize that question as the, back to that original point, is listening to somebody you really don't want to hear. And in one of the organizations that I'm working with, they decided to, there are two people in the network who are extreme deviants. Each, by the way, running a very successful branch of this organization. More successful than the center. The central group wanted to exclude them from the meeting. And I basically said, you guys are nuts. You can't deal with a creative deviant. No. But the same thing applies, that if the lower level employees have grievances that they are not open to, it's a serious, serious problem. And so it's this TV program about this the boss that goes to work with the people and finds out what's really going on in the company.
Undercover boss.
Undercover boss is very fascinating from that standpoint. And so the way you work with that is you just try to get the management team to open up to other things. And that same thing applies to whether they're talking about how do they work with the people or how do they work with the marketplace. Closed minds get you nowhere.
It seems to me that until people begin to recognize that the individual operates on the basis of his own desires and goals, and at some point you have to communicate that from one to the other. And they have to understand those goals and appreciate them and make a contribution, maybe not roll over, but make a contribution to allow you to reach your goals, and therefore I reach my goals.
Yeah.
Now, some may call that manipulation, so be it.
Yeah.
But until, you know, Congress is that way now, primarily because of this gerrymandering,
mm-hmm.
but they took away the goodie jar, too. Mm. You know, and you can't go home to the district and say, I got you a road.
Right, right.
That doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah.
So somebody has to figure out how to get that guy to be able to go home and say, I brought home the bacon, here
mm-hmm.
it is,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which will, you know, ingratiate him mm-hmm. to his constituents.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But some people seem to believe that there'll be a miracle that'll happen one night, and everyone will get up the next day and say, oh, you poor soul, can't I do something for you? Well, it's not going to happen, gang.
Yeah. Enlightened self-interest, yes. Yes. Yeah. You have a good story to go with that.
Yeah. It's a repair, not
yeah, okay.
I'm going to go back to the issue of the terrorists in France and elsewhere. My wife and I, we've been married 46 years. And over the years, she was a teacher, and I was my psych major undergraduate before I became a pharmacist. And we used to talk about the nature versus nurture issue. Mm-hmm. And we were in the 60s thinking that it's about a 50-50. Over the course of the last experiences and looking at what I think that there is, in fact, pure evil in the world, we've gotten to the point where there, according to our lights, are folks who are, we all saw the movie years ago, The Bad Seed. There are folks who are genuinely, you know, all babies are innocent, but perhaps some aren't. So what would you do in a situation when you're mediating, when you see that, and if you were asked to try to mediate in the Middle East between reasonable Islamists and a member of ISIS, for instance, who would teach a child to murder and go down the list, who is genuinely, have you ever had an experience where someone that you've been talking about, whether it's a corporate exec or the leader of the labor union, like that guy in New York, the cops, is may be genuinely evil and has been because of nature? Yeah, you see where I'm coming from?
Yeah, I see where you're coming from, and I feel totally inadequate to answer that question because I just seldom encounter somebody like that. And so then it gets down to power and manipulation, I think. What can you do to box them in or dull or give them something that they want? It's the extreme negotiation where you try to find out, okay, what's the minimum I'm willing to go for? How do I create enough pressure on the other side to have them at least come to a point I can minimally agree with?
Let me see if I can interject here. Madison, whenever you read about these people, the narrative is that they went back to the Middle East and were radicalized. So that tells me there's a pre-radicalization stage. And then there's a process they went through that's termed radicalization. And I think one of the things that has to be done is to find out what that radicalization process is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, the ultimate is that war is the ultimate diplomacy. It's like if you can't meet any common ground, then you start to shoot each other, you know. And so, but I'm in a state of great worry now about where the world stands from the standpoint of our internal politics to all the external stresses. It's an extreme case. Another thing we talk about a lot in my forums is leadership. And it's like if the Martian came down and said, take me to your leader, so where would we go? To me, leadership is not looking at where the troops are headed and then get in the middle of them. I think that one of the risks we do have, though, is that, and you can look at historical precedents for this, since we are in so much a state of chaos and confusion, that it is an opportunity for somebody who's an exceptionally strong leader and manipulator to take advantage of it. I think that's a risk.
I'd just like to pick up on what Terry just said about we have to find out what it is that works for the extremists to recruit the people that they recruit. But I think there's a huge lesson, whether or not we agree with their philosophical reasons for doing these things, there's a lot to be learned from people we don't agree with. And I think it gets back to the original topic and premise of this discussion. If we can identify why someone buys into a belief system that they do, we might be able to take some of that and put it into our own philosophical actions and reach some level of not necessarily understanding, but at least of acceptance of each other. And I think that's the bottom line.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. How many of you have lived in France? I lived in Paris for a year. And one of the characteristics of France that I think is quite different from us, and my wife is grew up in the Netherlands. She's an American citizen now, but has Dutch background. And I commented to something about the French melting pot. She said, "Well, Grant, you realize it's not a melting pot." And I said, "Whoops, yeah, you're right." And but what you find, and the papers have described it to a degree, but the minority communities in France, and to a certain extent Germany, not so much physically, but they're very much isolated, and so not really melded into the population the way we tend to do it. And so another way to look at this from a cultural standpoint and thinking about what happens before they're radicalized would be that all we can do as a society is to try to integrate people into our culture and to understand them better in an early stage, particularly with young people, the better off we're going to be. Isolation clearly won't work.
Two things. Part of the problem with the isolation is that they're also economically disadvantaged. And that's just a strong pattern. So if people are suffering from economic disadvantage, they have a sense of justified grievance.
Oh, yeah.
The other thing is that historically, from the reports that I've heard from the news, is that one of the seminal events that radicalized the Kouachi brothers was the invasion and war in Iraq. The Eastern Mennonite University has a peace institute that has been looking at enmity constructs and how that they perpetuate in cycles of action and retribution on both sides, where everyone feels justified because of some grave crime. I mean, if you want to radicalize someone, kill somebody they know. You know, if they watch the death of a friend or a family member, they're not going to have much love for you.
Yeah. Well, before I came over, I was listening to the Diane Rehm show that was talking about Nigeria and Boko Haram. And this very question came up about how could we intervene and negotiate with Boko Haram? And the people who were on the panel, they had some discussion about this. I don't know that they came to a conclusion, but at least one of them was saying it's unlikely, even if you could find the person to talk to, that you couldn't have the conversation. And so I think that goes back to the point you were making, is that, you know, when do you know that you have to fold up your diplomatic papers, walk out, and call the army? Yeah.
I liked what you said about bringing in the deviant, getting this back to management consulting. If I were a management consultant, the first thing I'd do is go to the human resources and get a list of all the malcontents, disciplinary cases, and long-term employees who'd left for another job.
Let me make a really radical statement. The human resources departments are the enforcers of the culture that the company has decided to perpetuate.
Yeah, I actually left off some of the question. Okay. I would then go interview these people, then, because that's the way you find out what's wrong with
the
company.
Right. Yeah, and actually, that's done in a lot of places in a way, because if you read exit interviews, if they're done right, you can learn a lot of that. But do people really change as a result? I don't know. Going back to IBM days, when I started with IBM, the thing was called personnel department. And the specific role of the personnel department was to help represent the people. That's turned around in recent years, where the HR department are basically the administrators of the benefits, and therefore have a role to protect the company's expenses. Okay, well, I haven't answered the big questions in the sky. Sorry about that, but it's a real pleasure to be here with you.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.